So, I don't know what really spurred this, and maybe Max, you can help me with it, but I got several of what Jarrett wrote to me. Jarrett wrote, is the uniform going to spear feather logo and Lombardi year throwback? First of all, the Lombardi year was the last year, 69, of the spear feather helmet. They then went to the R helmet in 70 and 71 before going to what we all know as the Redskin logo from 72 on, the one created by Blackie Wetzel. But I don't know. There was no news on this, no official news on anything dealing with the uniform. But I guess that there were some pictures circulating with this helmet, right? Last week for some reason?
No, so something happened at Media Day. They're just doing a bunch of, you know, normal photos, like team hype up stuff. And there is they have a set that's kind of like Temple of Doom style, where Jaden walks in and there's a spear that is going through like the ceiling in this big beam of light. And Jaden picks up the spear. And so that got everybody very excited. And people started speculating about whether that there would be a spear kind of alternate or a return to that type of uniform. So it all stems from this one video at Media Day.
Okay. Look, here's what I know. I told you this. This is what I had, remember, all the way back in October, in the fall, during this season. When we talked about this, it was one of the few times we actually talked about name or uniforms during the season, because the season was actually worth talking about on its own, because they had a really good season and the games were great. But I shared with you last fall, early in the fall, that I had learned that the name was, you know, very much in question as to whether or not they would do anything with that. You know, it was still certainly being considered. What really gave them the path of least resistance on the name was the incredible season they had. We all understand that. But I said then, I was told by a very, very strong source that they were going to do something with the uniforms, that they were going to make the uniforms look like the old uniforms, that whatever that cranberry was going to be back to the old burgundy, and the uniforms would change in 2025 as an alternate uniform for a couple of games, and then by the time we get to 2026, 2027, somewhere in that time frame, there would be more likely than not an official change to a uniform that looks more like what the old uniforms used to look like. You guys are bigger uniform nerds than me. So I'm not going to sit here and get into stripes and where they are in the entire thing. I was told that a uniform that looks like the old uniform and a change in the uniforms was definitely in play. That was last October when I said that. Okay, I told you guys that, and as it related to the name, even though I know our station put out some tweets about, you know, what I had said something, and I had not said it actually, I said that the name is separate, because that's a bigger issue and will be dealt with, and if they don't end up changing the name, they're still going to do something with the uniforms. And that's what I know to be true even today. Now, that does not include the old logo. That it doesn't, because it's not a match for the team name currently. And then with respect to spear and feather, arrow and feather, however you describe it, but I don't know anything about that. I just know, and I'll, again, what I said last October, fall, early fall, I have it on good authority that they are going to go back to something resembling the old uniforms, with sans the, you know, more recent Redskins logo. All right, so, and it would be a rollout with alt opportunities in 2025. How many alt opportunities? Don't they get 3 or 4 each year? Is that right, Max?
Something like that.
Yeah. So in these alt opportunities this year, I would imagine that at least in a couple of them, we're going to have a uniform that looks like the old uniform. All right. You know, I can't describe what the logo will be on the helmet. I'm going to guess that it's the W. I'm going to guess that they stick with that. And then eventually the plan would be to go back to something resembling the old uniform, sans the last logo, in the 26 season. That's nothing has changed. And I have occasional conversations with people about this, and that has been the same since October. Yeah, I'm excited to see what they look like. I hope it's, you know, championship burgundy and gold, you know? We see the uniform. If it doesn't include the helmet and the logo, so be it. But if the rest of the uniform looks like what our uniforms used to look like, I'll be thrilled with that. Be happy. So I think we'll probably see something resembling the older uniforms in the alt opportunities in the upcoming season. Remember, they have to announce their uniform schedule for the season at some point. I don't know by when. But in terms of why I had, you know, a half dozen to 10 of you reaching out asking about it, I guess it's what Max just said. I don't follow the day-to-day on the uniform talk. I don't. But I will, once again, in a few weeks, reach out to see if they're on, you know, on schedule for what I was told last October. All right? So there you go. Uniform talk. Done. Looking, you know what? How about opening up the season with an alt uniform? Are you allowed to do that? You allowed to open up the season against the Giants wearing a throwback uniform that you're eventually going to go to?
I don't think so, but seeing us come out, like, people hate on the black uniform. I kind of like it.
I didn't mind the black uniform at all.
It works with one specific helmet that I believe the NFL is starting to phase out, which is tough. It's the Speed Flex. It's the little hexagon with the W in the middle. That's what sells it for me. But aside from that, it would be really cool to see them come out like all black for opening week against the Giants. I think that would be a great look.
All right. Now, the other team, we already talked about Fred Smith. We talked about that in the open. And sort of a complicated view of Fred Smith for Redskin fans, for longtime Washington football fans. Phenomenal entrepreneur, you know, all time, you know, in part responsible for, along with the other two minority owners, for what ended up beginning, it ended up being the beginning of a process that led to Dan Snyder selling the team. But there's also no doubt that in their vindictive hatred of Snyder, they went scorched earth. And part of that was Fred Smith and Federal Express demanding that the name get changed in the summer of 2020. That adds sort of the complexity to the way Skins fans view Fred Smith. But anyway, we talked about that in the open of the show today. What was this Josh Harris buying this Jaden Daniels card? You know, some sort of Topps Chrome card that he purchased at Fanatics Fest, which I guess was over the weekend, because I did see last night some video of Jaden and Dan Marino together, which was pretty cool. But what, to explain the card that Josh Harris purchased.
So here's the audio from the video that Michael Rubin and Fanatics put out from the
Michael event. Rubin is the owner of Fanatics.
Yes. So
because he's been on Shark Tank a bunch of times.
Oh, yeah.
Really sharp dude. All right. So this is, what are we going to hear?
So this is Michael Rubin on stage with Josh Harris and Jaden Daniels asking about the card. He's looking for the most expensive card in the room. And I believe the guy who has the Jaden Daniels card is probably the front runner.
We need the most expensive Jaden Daniels card. Right,
we got it right here. Right here.
It's got the best opinion. Which card is it? Black Prism. What's it worth?
What's it worth, Rob?
$2 million.
$2 million.
What, Mike, what's this really worth?
Hey, Paul Skeens is 1.2. What's his best car worth?
That's a debut fest, huh?
That's all that matters. What do you want to sell?
That's the other one.
What's it really worth, Mike?
Can I say this? Alexis, Serena Williams' husband, put a public bounty on that card before it got pulled. First one for $250,000. First bounty, Raw. Before ever. So we outbid him, and now it's a 9-5. And Jaden cooked in the playoffs. We're the biggest Commander fans in the world.
In the world.
All right, one time, $500,000. You want it from Josh Harris with Jaden here right now. And you're going to sign Jaden's jersey back to it. $500,000 one time. You want it? Yes or no? Yes or no?
Oh, my God!
So that's the audio of the card being sold to Josh Harris.
So Josh Harris told Ruben, I'm offering $500,000. He went back to the owner of the card. Will you take it? They took it. Done.
Yeah, Harris was standing right over his shoulder, and I'm sure said something to Ruben. He's like, $500,000, offer it to him right now. And so the guy got up on stage. They took a picture. Jaden signed the jersey.
But these guys were looking for $250,000, and he offered $500,000?
So Serena Williams' husband put a $250 or $250.
Who's Serena Williams' husband?
He's the CEO of Reddit. I forget his name off the top of my head.
I didn't know that, I don't think.
Yeah.
Maybe I didn't know
that. He went to UVA, so he's a local guy, kind of. But he put out a bounty of $250,000 for the card, and I guess these guys outbid him, so I'm guessing that they paid, let's just say, $300,000 for it. So they flipped it and sold it to Josh for $500,000. So a little $200,000 profit. You meet Jaden Daniels, you get a signed jersey, and you get the whole photo op. I think that's well worth it.
And this card is literally only one is made?
Yeah.
That's why it's so valuable?
So from Fanatics Collect, so the Washington Commanders owner, Josh Harris, bought Jaden Daniels Prism Black Finite 1/1 for $500,000. So it is a 1/1 card and is the most expensive Jaden Daniels card sale ever.
It's obviously a rookie card.
Yes.
There's no other card for him.
Correct.
Yeah. I'm reading something about grading services. The card received a 9.5. Is that just the condition of the card?
Pretty much, yeah. If you anywhere between like a 9.5 and a 10 is like damn near perfect. Okay. Anything lower than that, like still, if you got a 9 card, like you
okay,
got a pretty good card.
Immediately, I'm curious. Does Josh Harris literally just pull out a checkbook, or does he just get wiring instructions and wire them $500,000 and then they turn the card over? Do you have any idea how that transaction's completed? And then what is Josh Harris going to do with the card?
So I'm not 100% sure on like how the transaction was completed. I'm sure I don't know if he had his checkbook on him, but I'm sure he got the guy's info, gave him all that. But they plan on it's going to be a business write-off. They're going to display it at Northwest Stadium.
They're going to display it?
Yeah,
is that an exciting display? A display?
It's going to be. It's something to cool to look at.
It is.
Something pass by and be like,
is it worth the $500,000?
When you see it, you'll see $500,000 right there in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I mean, is that something that you think our fans are like really impressed that Josh Harris did?
I mean,
or does he now have to do it with Sandristil's card too?
I was driving.
Give up $50,000 for that or whatever it'd be worth.
Well, so I was driving into work today. And Eric Bickle had quite the take on the junkies this morning that I'm probably going to borrow. If Josh Harris is spending $500,000 willy-nilly on a Jaden Daniels card, surely they can afford to pay Terry McLaurin a few extra $1 million, right?
Yeah, but, this is a marketing expense. It's probably...
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a little bit different. They can afford to pay Terry. Of course they can.
Of course.
But, the issue is, like we talked about, this is the most expensive player investment they're going to make, or it will make, since they bought the team. All right. I mean, honestly, just me, not a big collector of anything. I'm very much a minimalist. People walk into my home, my wife is sort of the same way, and it's like, you basically have a silver bowl with like a green apple in it. We're just minimalists at the highest level. I do have a big box up in my attic with a bunch of stuff in it, including, and I've not opened it, football cards that I was given during the Super Bowl back in 91, and I think they're rookie cards. I've looked into it. I don't think there would be anything worth a significant amount of money, even if it was in there. But I don't have... I just don't collect stuff. This is so not interesting to me. And I know it's big business. Trust me. I know it is. There's no chance that I would go out of my way to see the card on display at Northwest Field. But for those that will, good job, Josh. Good job. $500,000 for a card. Okay.
It's 1/1.
Yeah. It's 1/1.
Unmoved. You are unmoved. The least moved anyone's ever been about this issue.
Not... Honestly, I'm interested because I'm always curious about things, especially when they're sort of the business of it. I am interested in that part. I'm just, from a consumer standpoint, you're not going to get me to be excited about seeing that on display.
Yeah,
it just doesn't.
Get that.
Yeah, I'm going to be much more excited to see him throw for five touchdowns and beat the Eagles again, like he did in December.
Fair.
All right, when we come back, I had Logan Paulson on the show last week on my podcast. I played some of that for you on Friday. I'm going to play the rest of it for you when we come back. He talks about the defense and what this team can be if it's much better defensively. You'll hear that next. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com. All right, switching subjects. A lot of NBA for this show today, but the Wizards made a big trade, and we've got a draft tonight, and Linnell will be on our coverage tonight on draft coverage here on the station. Joining us right now is Scott Abraham from Channel 7, of course, at Scott7 News on X on Twitter. You had some news yesterday. Share it with everybody as it relates to the RFK site, the DC Council vote, and even what the stadium may ultimately look like when it does get built.
Yeah, always glad to be on with you, Kevin. Appreciate you having me on. Obviously, you know, you're just doing some thinking. It's getting closer and closer, right, to July 15th. You know, yesterday was 3 weeks away for the proposed vote by the D.C. Council to kind of send this through to get this shovels in the ground and start building a stadium. And, you know, talking to a source of basically where it's at, what's going on, and, you know, the source believes the team is still very confident that there's going to be a path to get this done in D.C. And, you know, just some other interesting nuggets, you know, through the conversation is just from a design aspect and kind of thinking about what the stadium might look like at the RFK site. Basically, the team is not ruling out anything in terms of, like, obviously they want the roof. That's going to be priority number one. And that,
they
that
have
allows
to have a roof, whether it's retractable correct or not. You don't get a Super Bowl without it.
Correct. So the roof is but the question is it going to be a retractable roof? And that's on the table, right? So that's something that I kind of found out in terms of, you know, they're trying to figure out the cost value of that and the best place to invest the money into the stadium, because this is a heavy lift. And I think what was key that came out to my conversation was they want to make sure that they bring, like, the outside in and the utilization of glass, utilization of design, of making sure you can have those sight lines of what DC looks like. So it's still very early in the planning stages, but I found that interesting that a retractable roof is not off the table. It's in conversation. And then the other interesting nugget, Kevin, because I was curious about this, is, you know, RFK site. It's always been RFK Stadium, RFK site. What do they think about the utilization of keeping RFK in the new stadium name? And they're having conversations about that as well. Could it be Northwest Field at RFK Stadium, or, you know, and that type of scenario? So
right,
RFK, that name, is still being considered as part of the new stadium. So just some interesting nuggets as we get closer to July 15th. Obviously, everybody's kind of on pins and needles, figuring out what's going to happen with the council.
What have you heard, if anything, as it relates to the difference in price between retractable roof and an actual non-retractable roof? Because I'm under the understanding that it's a much more expensive endeavor.
Yeah, I don't know the exact number, but just, you know, from, you know, reading and doing my own research, not necessarily talking to the source about numbers, it's a much more big figure because of the mechanical operation and just the technological capabilities you would need to have that retractable roof. So that's just part of the trying to figure out, you know, where the best place to invest your money into a new stadium, the cost value, what is the benefit of a retractable roof versus a roof that doesn't retract. So can they put that money into different, you know, glass panels, where almost like an Allegiant Stadium in Vegas, where you still have, you know, that the glass in the end zone type deal. So they're obviously in the early stages of talking to design firms and figuring out the best course of action and how they want this to look. I know the team, you know, they've visited numerous stadiums over the past couple of years, from SoFi to Allegiant to Atlanta, trying to figure out, you know, what they did, what they liked, what they didn't like, and what fits in their own bucket. So a lot of planning right now.
So we're talking to Scott Abraham from Channel 7. So let's, you know, we had this story last week in the Post, you know, the mayor saying that the team is outraged that the city council has taken this much time to get the information necessary to, you know, and then asking for more time beyond July 15th as if that's not really a big deal to them when it is a big deal to the team. What are you hearing as it relates to if they didn't vote by July 15th? Will the team go back? Because that then the negotiation then becomes non-exclusive so that they could go back to Maryland. But are you hearing, and it sounds like you are, they're going to get this vote done by July 15th?
So that's a great question. That's a question on listeners, viewers' minds, and I totally get it. And I honestly think that in their heart of hearts, the team perspective, they're going to get this done in D.C. They feel like there's a runway in D.C. that they're going to be able to figure this out and get this done. Remember, they did the same thing, you know, the late night backdoor deals in the Congress and the land transfer. So in the last minute, midnight hour, that's kind of their M.O. So I think there's a confidence there. They're not even thinking, Kevin, down that road of like, what if, you know, this, you know, publicly or talking, you know, talking to media members or myself, maybe behind closed doors, they have plan A, B, and C. But I think publicly they think this is going to get done and that they're not really thinking about a plan B, plan C. They're putting all their eggs in the basket of Washington, D.C. And I understand from a commander's perspective, from a Mayor Muriel Bowser, of why they want to get this done on July 15th, because in terms of planning and booking these big events like a Final Four, or WrestleMania, they need to have shovels in the ground to show them, hey, this is getting it done. And they want to put, you know, big events on the books in 2026, 2027 for 2030, 2031. So that's why this is kind of a timetable rush against time. It's all about time. The clock is chasing them, almost like radio, almost like TV. The clock is always chasing us, and the clock is chasing them in terms of July 15th, because if it gets pushed down the road, you know, kick the can down the road, that means in terms of building out their calendar, building out big events, that's going to get pushed down the road as well. So a lot of different layers to all this, Kevin.
Trust me, it's annoying right now to people like Josh Harris, Mark Gein, Mitchell Rails, you know, private sector entrepreneurs who, you know, saw this deal in the hands of the city council, you know, at the end of April, and they can't, you know, lock themselves into a room and figure this thing out in time for July 15th. It's just a different speed when you're talking bureaucracy versus, you know, guys like Harris, Ein, Rails, and probably the majority of people who are limited partners in the ownership of the team. So I hope they, you know, figure out how to get a sense of urgency and get this thing voted 7 votes yes by July 15th. So you would also, go ahead.
Kevin, to your point, sorry to cut you off. Like selfishly, and like I would love a brand new stadium in Washington, D.C., but I also understand the other side of the coin from what Council Chairman Phil Mendelson, you know, they want to do their due diligence. They want to make sure this is the right deal for them and for the city and for the constituents and for the neighborhoods and for people that live in that area. I totally get it. There's a lot of money being thrown around, taxpayer dollars, private money. I understand the whole essence of time, but, you know, ultimately, I think if you have this stadium, a brand new stadium, an anchor for a city, an anchor for a community, taking the journalism hat off, I think the good will outweigh maybe the negative.
You know, I totally agree with that. It is their job to get the best possible deal for tax-paying citizens in the District of Columbia. The question is, why does it need to take 2.5 months or longer for them to do it? Look, you also tweeted something else out yesterday regarding tailgating. I know that's a big issue for younger fans. What would, you know, assuming this gets done and the stadium gets built in 2030, opens up, what would the tailgating situation be like down there?
the source told me basically there's going to be designated tailgating areas. So if you think of, you know, Northwest Stadium, FedEx Field days, you know, you can basically tailgate anywhere. The parking lot is an open field. I think it's obviously going to be set up a little bit differently at the RFK site, and I think there's going to be specific tailgating areas where you'll be restricted to that parking lot or to that area to tailgate. So what I'm getting at is I don't think it's going to be as vast as you've seen at FedEx sure. Field or Northwest Stadium driving, you know, around the stadium. You see everybody park, you know, tailgating in various parking lots. I don't think that's going to be like that at all from what I'm hearing, from what's being told to me. So I think it's going to be skewed down. I don't think it'd be as vast, but there are going to be elements where people that want to tailgate will be able to do so at designated areas. So I think fans that have the belief that there's going to be no tailgating, I've been told, and I think they need to understand that that's not going to be the case, that there are going to be designated spots for tailgating at the new stadium.
All right. While we have you on, and we're talking to Scott Abraham from Channel 7, yeah. Scott is a Syracuse grad, hence a basketball fan. You have to be if you go to Syracuse. So yeah. What do you want to see the Wizards do tonight at 6-18? Do you have preferences?
Boy, I just, you know, the whole Ace Bailey conversation debate is very interesting, and just doing a lot of reading and seeing why he's doing it, what he's doing in terms of not working out or taking teams' phone calls. Normally, that would be a red flag to me, but just the upside and the talent of a young prospect. He's so young. What is he, 18, 19 years old?
Yeah, they all are, basically.
If he's available at number 6, I would love an Ace Bailey, because I think that would be an anchor, a guy you could put on a side of the billboard, you know, build a marketing around. And I think that's what Ace and his team wants. I think they don't want him to get lost in the shuffle of going to a Sixers team that has Maxey or Embiid and be, you know, the third or fourth fiddle, where you come to D.C. and you can be the dude. If Ace Bailey is there, I think that would be fantastic for Washington, because he was obviously pegged for a top 3 slot, and this whole nonsense of him not working out and, you know, being difficult, I guess, for teams to work with may work in Washington's favor.
How do you think it'll work out with Terry McLaurin?
I think it's going to get done before training camp starts. I think, you know, just the negotiating, the posturing that's been going on, and that's just been the MO the last time around when he wanted a contract extension. I think that got done early July. I think this is going to get done before training camp. The team understands how valuable Terry is on the field. That's a given, his physical traits, but you can't put a price tag on the human that Terry McLaurin is in that locker room, in the community, how he is as on the microphone, as almost like a spokesperson for the team a lot of times, when just how well he talks publicly. He's just a rare breed of an athlete, of the talents he shows on the field and the leadership he shows in the locker room, in the community. And when it just shows you, when he has a serviceable quarterback, a very good quarterback like a Jaden Daniels, look at the type of numbers he can produce. So I think it's going to get done. I think that magic number is probably going to be $30 million. I think that's the marker. And ultimately, I think it's going to get done before training camp starts.
How long have you been in town for? How long have you been at Channel 7?
Yeah, 2016. I got here January 2016.
Wow.
So it'll almost be 10 years. So I've seen a lot with that franchise. And it's been, last year was awesome, Kevin. It was, you know, I've said it publicly, and I may have told you before, I wish I could experience what RFK was like. And I never had that opportunity. And obviously I've seen videos and clips and stories from, you know, former Washington legends, what it was like being there and playing there. And I wish I could experience that. And to see that kind of come to fruition on a smaller scale last year, and see the excitement, how the town and the city just got captivated around this NFC championship birth, that last year was a lot of fun, and I want more of that. So I'm really excited about this upcoming year and years to come with this regime and Jaden under center.
I think you've told me this before. You're from upstate New York, right?
Yes. Yep. Utica, New York. Yep. I went to Syracuse, so yep.
Were you a Bills fan growing up?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Long-suffering Bills fan, Kevin. So my childhood was those four Super Bowls. I was born in 83, so I was, what, 7, 8, 9, 10? Those four Super Bowls. So Kelly, Thurman Thomas, Andre Reed, they're my heroes. So I'm hoping one day, you know, I could experience the Eagles did, you know, maybe winning that Super Bowl. Obviously, you know, they're still near dear in my heart. But, yeah, I was a Bills fan growing up.
All right, one last one on this team, because you've been here now and you've experienced the absolute worst. Yeah. All of it, but last year got to be a part of, you know, this resurrection season. So entering year two of Jaden Daniels and Dan Quinn and company, what are you most confident about as it relates to this team, and what concerns you?
Most confident is the offense. I think they're going to be putting up points. I think they fortify that offensive line. They got more weapons in terms of Debo, and you have the Swiss Army knife, the capabilities that he can bring. And I think the offense is going to score points. They're going to be moving up and down the field. I'm not worried about a blueprint in terms of slowing down Jaden. I love the fact they have the continuity, the coaching staff returning, especially in that, you know, offensive room with Cliff Kingsbury and Tavita Pritchard and David Blau to help with the growth and development of Jaden. The offense is going to be terrific. They're going to be just fine. I think the key to the offense is going to be the running game from running backs. Too many times last year, Jaden Daniels led the team in running. I want to see Brian Robinson Jr. have a monster year, stay healthy, and really take hold of that backfield being at a contract year. I think B-Rob is one of the key layers, the key element to the offense. My big question mark, maybe concern, and I think that's been talked about at nauseam from media members, radio, TV, is the defense. I don't think necessarily they got better. And last year they had plenty of warts. Who's going to stack the quarterback in terms of you got to, you know, make up the loss of Fowler, who was the leading sack getter for Washington? Will Frankie Louvu be more of a pass rusher? How will the secondary look? In terms of the new pieces, Jeremy Chin gone, Benjamin St. Juice gone. So who's going to fill those roles of Trey Amos and Will Harris? And then the defensive line, obviously Jonathan Allen gone. They brought in some bigger bodies to stop the run. So the defense is going to be my concern, my question mark. I don't want to shoot out every game. I don't want a 42-35, you know, type of game. You know, might be exciting for fans, but I want to see some more from the defense. And that's going to be my big question going into 2025 here.
Thanks, Scott, for doing this. Good information on the stadium. Appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Talk soon. Thanks, Kev.
Scott Abraham, everybody. When we come back, the Philly Voice, that would be the PhiladelphiaVoice.com, just put out a story, 10 reasons the Commanders will be a dumpster fire this season. This should be an entertaining read. Let's do it together when we come back. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com.
With the sixth pick in the 2025 NBA Draft, the Washington Wizards select Trey Johnson from the University of Texas.
So, with the understanding, Max, and all of you listening, that we don't know anything really about 18 and 19-year-olds entering a grown man league, which is what the NBA is, it's not going to stop any of us from having an opinion. It's not going to stop me from having an opinion on what the Wizards did last night, and I won't bury the lead. I liked it. Good morning, everybody. Eric Flack from WUSA Channel 9 will join me in about 40 minutes with the latest on the RFK deal. There are hurdles still yet to clear. And some of those were put up in front of the team and in front of the mayor yesterday. So we'll get the latest on that. I know that there's a lot of angst with many of you about what the city council is doing and how long they're taking, and now separating it from the actual budget bill and not getting it voted on by the deadline on the initial deal, the initial term sheet that was negotiated July 15th, and the situation that puts the team into. Eric Flack, WUSA, Channel 9, in 40 minutes to explain all of it. Chase Hughes, who covers the Wizards for Monumental Sports, will be our guest at 11, and there's a possibility of another guest during the 12 o'clock hour. You're going to hear everybody that spoke last night about the Wizards draft, including the general manager, Will Dawkins, who held a press conference after round one, and we'll get what his thinking was on Trey Johnson and on Will Riley. So, I saw a friend of mine this morning getting coffee, and he's a big Hoops fan, big Wizards fan, and I said, so what did you think? And he said, they drafted LaBradford Smith. I'm like, oh my God. He's like, he plays just like him. You know, everybody's got an opinion. And I said, well, you know what? You might be right. You might be right. LaBradford Smith, of course, of the famous LaBradford Smith story is when he scored, I think it was like 38 against Jordan in Chicago in the early 90s, and said to him after the game, put his arm around him and said, nice game, Mike. And they played the next night or two nights later, and Jordan told his teammates, I want to get 37 in the first half against this guy. It turns out he ended up with 47 for the game. Now, I do think I remember from The Last Dance, Jordan said he kind of exaggerated that story about LaBradford Smith. Is that what it was? He made the whole thing up,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he made it up all in his head. Yeah, to motivate himself, as you know, true competitors do.
Yeah, hard to change a story like that with one documentary, but you remembered that he changed, that he gave us the truth in The Last Dance, and I remembered that there was something in there about it, but still, one of those great Jordan stories. I don't know if Trey Johnson's going to end up being a LaBradford Smith. Look, I liked the pick. We talked about Trey Johnson a lot on the show yesterday in particular. That was of the guys that were more likely than not going to be there at six. That's who I wanted. I think that Trey Johnson comes into this league with something that you're guaranteed to get. You don't know about a lot of things when they're 18 or 19 years old, but when you can shoot the basketball like he can, and he is a very good shooter. I mean, the stroke is perfect. It's perfect off the bounce. It's perfect off the catch. It's perfect posting up and fading away. It's perfect at the free throw line. When you get a player that can shoot, that's something that never goes away. I mean, he'll be 75, and he'll still be burying jump shots from 23, 24 feet. So they got something in Trey Johnson that you know he'll bring to the NBA. Now, all of the rest of it, can he guard? Can he play pick and roll? Can he get to the rim? Can he finish at the rim? Can he play in all sorts of different environments and systems and with certain kinds of players versus others? We'll learn all that. He's 19 years old. What you saw at Texas was you saw a guy who was legitimately high-level competitor, fearless. His very first game, we talked about some of his games on the show yesterday. His very first game, Ohio State in Vegas, he goes out and gets 29. On 20 shot attempts in his first game as a true freshman, 10 threes. He was 5 for 10 from behind the arc. He was 10 for 20 from the floor, and he had 29 points. In the SEC, you played against the best. That league last year was unbelievable. It basically, what did we have at one point? Four of the top five teams in the country were out of the SEC. You know, Florida, Auburn, Alabama, and Tennessee. I think we're all in the top five simultaneously. Kentucky was really good. Ole Miss was good. Texas A&M was good. Arkansas came on at the end of the year. The league was brutal. So he went against the best. And he did well against the best. And yeah, there were nights where he didn't shoot it well. There were nights where he was held down a bit. But this guy, if you watched anything leading into the draft, even if it was just highlights, which does not tell the whole story, you realize that this dude was highly competitive, that he is not only a shooter, but a scorer, and he's absolutely fearless and confident. I don't know what the hell he was wearing last night with the white socks. It looked a little bit odd, but I loved the interview that he did with his father, with Monica McNutt. I thought that was a great interview, and he ribbed his father a little bit for kind of forgetting his age. But I love Trey Johnson. I was not an Ace Bailey guy. Ace Bailey is incredibly talented, but look, we're not going to ever need to, you know, debate that because he wasn't available. He went, very surprisingly to him, to Utah at number 5, the pick before the Wizards picked. You know, there was a lot of discussion about Ace Bailey on the pregame and during those first picks. You know, the pre-draft process that was not handled well, at least based on how NBA teams viewed it. And, you know, that was one of the reasons he had been mocked for 2 years in the top 3 and was potentially falling to the Wizards at 6 or perhaps even further than that. Some suggested that Ace Bailey had a deal in hand, had a commitment from a team in hand, and that's why he ditched the pre-draft process. He was okay going to, say, the Wizards at 6. Well, it turns out he goes to Utah at 5, and he claims there was no deal, and he was surprised and said he had no clue that they were interested in him. So we'll never have to debate, unless you feel like they should have been aggressive in trying to trade up. And look, there were stories out there earlier in the week that the Wizards were interested in trading up. We don't know if it was for Bailey. It could have been for Edgecombe. It could have been for Dylan Harper. Could have been for Knupple. Who knows who it was for? But they weren't able to trade up, even if there was some interest in trading up. They did not have the choice of Ace Bailey and other players. They had the choice of Trey Johnson, if you were a Jeremiah Fears fan. I was very surprised to see Yegor Demin, the player that I was hoping the Wizards at 18, if they didn't get Derek Queen in a trade-up, I was hoping Demin might be there at 18, or they might only have to trade up a few spots. I saw his mocks from anywhere from 12 to 22. So when he went 8, I was surprised. I thought he was the best passer of the players that I watched in sort of looking ahead to this draft. And at 6'8", 6'9", that he was actually going to be able to play point guard in the NBA. He went 8 overall. I doubt the Wizards were going to take him at 6, but who knows? Well, they didn't, because they took Trey Johnson. I love Trey Johnson as a college player, as a one-year college player, as a 19-year-old. I think this guy has a chance to be a big-time scorer in the NBA. We'll find out. One thing he can do, there is no doubt about this, he can shoot it. And I think he can score, not just as a shooter, but as an off-the-dribble creator scorer, as a post-up at 6'5", 6'6". So I'm excited about Trey Johnson. I think, you know, with Carrington, with, you know, it'll be C.J. McCollum. Look, with C.J. McCollum and Marcus Smart on the roster, you've got two veteran players who are also two high IQ veteran players, in Smart's case, high IQ and highly competitive. Like, you know, it'll be a good, I think, developmental situation for Trey Johnson. And then the Wizards at 18 traded back. And I got to tell you, man, at 18, I kept thinking, Walter Clayton Jr. We talked about him a lot. I didn't understand why he was being mocked in the 20s, you know, somewhere from like 22 to 28, you saw with Clayton Jr. It didn't make any sense to me. I thought he should have been in the lottery personally. But when he was there at 18, which we expected he would be, and the Wizards were on the clock, I'm like, that's who they have to take. They've got to take Walter Clayton Jr. I don't care that he's you know, an old man at 22. I don't care that he played 4 years of college basketball, not all of it, at high level, the last two at Florida. The guy is a big-time scorer. He is a separator. He's got a quick release. He is clutch. You know, there was some, you know, talk about they didn't think he was a good decision maker in pick and roll. I didn't see that. And sure enough, Washington at 18, on behalf of the Utah Jazz after they traded back, the Utah Jazz selected Walter Clayton Jr. at 18. I saw that the trade was in the process of being made, and then when I saw who Utah took, I was like, you've got to be kidding me. So the Wizards went back, and at 21, they took Will Riley, another player that we mentioned yesterday. I said at 18, here are the guys that if they took them, I wouldn't be upset. And Will Riley was one of those guys. Will Riley was the sixth man of the year in the Big Ten. Another super competitive, high motor, you know, player. He can really shoot it. You know, I watch a lot of Big Ten basketball, Maryland, obviously, in particular, but watch a bunch of Big Ten games. And that's kind of it this past year until the tournament or late in the season, in part because we had a really good football team that was playing deep into January. But Will Riley just kept getting more minutes, getting more trust, and you could see he could play. Like, he had NBA potential, and I liked the pick. You know, they traded back and got a guy that I'm sure they felt like they could get at 21, because I think for the most part, Will Riley was late first round projected, mid to late 20s, some second round in mocks. I like Will Riley. I liked watching him this year when he was at Illinois. You know, Illinois is one of the few Big Ten teams that plays kind of an NBA style. They play a lot of up-tempo, a lot of taking it out of the, you know, off the rim and pushing it, taking it out of the bucket and inbounding it and getting it up court. They've always played that way. And I like both picks. I would have preferred Clayton Jr. I would have preferred a trade-up to get Derek Queen. Yes, Derek Queen would have been phenomenal, even with a trade-up. Who else in this draft at 18? At 18, honestly, I was like, it's Clayton Jr. And then when they traded back, I was like, well, Will Riley's on the board, and the guy Newell is on the board. We talked a little bit about him. I think Neek Clifford's on the board. I know we talked about him from Colorado State, the kid who had a great game against Maryland in the tournament. We talked about Jace Richardson from Michigan State, Jason Richardson's son. So there were a bunch of guys there. So any of those guys I would have been fine with. I like the draft, but what the hell do we know? 18, 19 years old. It's going to play out over 6-7 years. You know, I went back yesterday after the show because I wanted to kind of get a sense of what the NBA draft really is. Because I've said many times over the years, look, this is not the NFL draft. This is a draft in which a smaller, much smaller percentage of the players that are picked are not going to contribute. And in fact, many of them won't even be in the league in 5 years. And if they are in the league, they're at the end of a bench somewhere. The NFL draft, by definition, because of roster size, is just a much better opportunity. You know, more players are selected because there are more jobs available. 53-man rosters, 90 people that go to camp. The NBA is just much different, much smaller rosters. Not to mention, the NBA draft typically is picking from a pool of players that have played, on average, probably a year and a half to 2 years. Whereas in the NFL, it's 3 to 4 years, sometimes more than that. And physical maturity and mental maturity, you would think that it's more important in the NFL, but actually it's equal. The NBA is a grown man's league. Older teams, until this year, older teams typically are teams that win the most. You really don't know about a player until he's been in the league 4 to 5 years. If he comes in at 18, that's 22, 23. 19, 20, that's 23, 24, 25. You really don't know. I went back yesterday, and I just went back 8 years in the draft. arbitrarily, I just picked 2017. Other years would have matched up. But I'm like, 8 years, you know, when you're coming in at 18, 19, and you're 25, 26, 27, that's kind of the prime of somebody's career. Maybe the beginning of the prime in NBA terms, but it's in the prime. And I went back, and when you look at the 2017 draft, it produced two players who we would all say are star players. One of them you might say superstar, you know, borderline debatable top five. Those two players, and it was only two, Jason Tatum and Donovan Mitchell. Out of 60 players picked, two turned into massive contributing star players. You go through the drafts that followed. It was like 2018, you only had two, Luka and SGA. 2019, you didn't really have any. You don't have any star players from that draft. Zion Williamson went number one overall. Ja Morant was super early. You know, Zion Williamson has star potential, can't stay healthy. Ja Morant, you could call him a borderline star, but he can't seem to stay out of trouble or can't stay healthy. 2020 was Anthony Edwards and Tyrese Halliburton. That's the list. When you go back to 2017, listen to this. 17 of the 60 players, 17, are still in the league playing, in getting ready to play, or having played their eighth season. 17 out of the 60. 30 out of the 60 were out of the league in 5 years or less. Half the players. So its impact, you know, is legitimate if you can find a player or two. It's just so hard to find those players. And they come in all manners, all spots in the draft. We know that. You know, just look at recent MVPs. Jokic 41st in the second round. SGA at 11. Kawhi at 15. Giannis at 15. Steph at 7 overall. The Wizards' goal last night was to be in 5, 6, 7 years, 8 years from now. You look back on 2025 and you say, they got one of the two. They got one of the two or three that legitimately turned into a star. They got it number six in Trey Johnson. They got it right. Or at 21, they got it right with Will Riley. Turned into a star. Would have been much more fun last night had the Wizards had the first pick. Had they won the draft lottery and been able to select Cooper Flagg. I was thinking about that, and I'm sure we talked about it on draft lottery day after. But if the Wizards had had the first pick in the draft last night, that would have been a massive local story. Massive. Because the Wizards, let's face it, of the four professional teams, you can throw in some of the college teams, they are dead last right now in relevance. Dead last. Now, I like what they're doing. I think what they're doing is the right way to do it. It doesn't guarantee anything, but I am on board and was on board when Winger and Dawkins and company came in and said, this is what we're going to do. I am on board for this. And we are now, you know, in our third draft. By the way, they added a second round pick, so they're back in the draft as part of the trade back with Utah. They also added two future second rounders for the three spot drop. So they do have a second rounder tonight. It's 43 overall. They were at 40 overall. They traded that to New Orleans as part of the Jordan Poole, CJ McCollum, Kelly Olynyk trade. I like what they're doing. We're in the third of what will probably be 4 to 5 drafts that have to produce either enough ammo to make trades to bring in star players, or right before they become star players, or land those star players via these 4 to 5 drafts. We're in draft 3 of probably 5 drafts that will tell the tale 5 years from now. And so far, they've added good players, Koulibaly and Sarr and George and Carrington and A.J., you know, Johnson, you know, and hopefully last night, Trey Johnson and Will Riley. You know, there is some promise. God, they are young. They are, we got a lot of 18, 19, 20, and 21-year-olds. And, you know, if you're interested, then you'll pay attention to this process of watching them play NBA games and seeing whether or not the Wizards got it right from an evaluation standpoint. That's most important. And then secondly, almost as important, player development. You got to be really good at developing these players when you get them. And then you got to be really good at retaining them. So there's still, you know, other things that have to happen. But I like the draft. I, you know, as much as you can like it without really knowing much about players this age. I was a fan of Trey Johnson heading into this draft and said that I wanted them to take Trey Johnson at 6. That was of the players that were more likely than not going to be available. At 18, I would have loved Walter Clayton Jr. I really wanted Derrick Queen. He ended up going 13 to New Orleans after a trade. And that might be a good fit. They've got to be a healthy team, obviously. Once he was gone, Yegor Damon was gone. I loved him. Walter Clayton Jr. Was fine for me at 21. I'm sorry, Will Riley was fine for me at 21, but I would have preferred Walter Clayton Jr. at 18, which is what Utah took after trading up with the Wizards. Mentioned Queen. I have not mentioned Sorber. Wow, was he emotional. Good for him. He goes to the champs at 15. From Georgetown, the 6'9 big from Georgetown. You know, I watched the whole draft. There are things about the draft that are just so infuriating. I don't know why the NBA can't get this right. Why do they do what they do on draft night with trades? I know it has something to do with the league calendar and trades can't become official, etc., but stop it. This is a television show. You've got to make it easy for your fans, for the consumers of this, and you just make it so hard. It's not that hard. We have a trade. The Washington Wizards at 18 have traded number 18 to the Utah Jazz for the Utah Jazz's first round pick number 21 overall, their second round pick number 43 overall, and two future second round picks. With the 18th pick in the 2025 NBA draft, the Utah Jazz select Walter Clayton Jr. And then when he walks to the stage, they have a Utah Jazz hat, not a Wizards hat, for him to put on. It's been the dumbest thing for years. I don't care about, you know, CBAs and trade official debt, you know, when trades can become official. It's all so dumb, and it's terrible for the consumer, and it's terrible for their draft presentation. It's terrible. Not only that, last night you had the situation in which the commissioner was stepping to the podium and announcing trades that had happened 4 and 5 picks earlier, and then confusing everybody even more before the team that was on the clock, who had also traded, but then he announces it as their pick. My God, Adam Silver is a smart guy. How he hasn't, you know, gotten together with everybody around the table and said, we got to fix this. This is a very confusing night for our fans. And by the way, for people who are casual fans of the league, the NFL draft has become, let's face it, after the NFL games and college football games, the NFL draft is probably the third most popular, you know, product out there. They do it right. Could you imagine Goodell and the other owners, if they're, you know, got guys coming up, putting on, you know, holding up jerseys of the wrong team, not the team that they were going to play for? It's got to be one of the dumbest things in sports. And how a smart guy like Adam Silver hasn't solved it, I don't know. And you had so many trades last night, so the confusion level was at an all-time high. All right. Max wants to weigh in. I want to know what Max thinks about these picks. I'm also going to play for you some of what Will Dawkins, the general manager of the Wizards, what he said about their draft last night. We'll do that and more and get an update at 10:40 from Eric Flack from Channel 9 on the latest regarding the RFK site deal. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com. All right, joining us right now, the Wizards have had a busy week, and this man's had a very busy week. The trade on Tuesday with New Orleans, two first-round picks on Wednesday night, and then they added another pick last night. Joining me right now, and it's a pleasure, Wizards General Manager Will Dawkins. Will, thanks. I appreciate you giving me some time this morning. All the months of preparation, if not years, really. And, you know, the two nights just fly by. It's over in like 28 hours. You've been through a ton of these during your career. I'm sure some of them go kind of how you plan them to go. Others end up being surprises after surprises. How would you describe this one?
Yeah, first off, thanks for having me. Happy to be on this morning. I would say very rarely do they go as you plan. I think a lot of times you just put in the work and preparation and try to build through every contingency you can think through. And we try to do that for as long as possible. But I'd say last 2 days were fun for our group. We got better and we're able to get guys that we were targeting. So we felt good about the outcome for sure.
So rarely it goes the way it's supposed to. In the first round, you're sitting there at six. Did it go the way you thought it would go? And did you get the guy you wanted?
Yeah, Trey's someone that we were excited about, who was in our top five all year. Won't tell you where he was, but he was up there. And when you get that guy, when you fall out of the top five on lottery night, you still feel pretty good about that. So our scouts were on him early, and we went to see him practice, play a lot early, and he just was able to continue that run in SEC play. The scoring prowess that he had was really impressive for a freshman.
So what did you love most about him?
Once we got to know him, during the visit, I really fell in love with his passion for the game, his IQ, and his ability to see the game and be ahead of plays. We threw him in a couple film sessions, put him in the workout, and threw him in Wizards play calls, and he picked up on stuff really quickly. But at the end of the day, he's a pure hooper. He's someone that has a repeatable shot. It's rare when you find someone who can shoot the ball with the same efficiency off the dribble as he does off the catch at such a high clip. So he's someone that's going to score. He's got to get better scoring at the rim, but he can score from deep. He can score from the mid-range, and he's got a passing creativity that will be, I think, exposed a little bit and enlightened a little bit more when he's with us.
Is it true, in your opinion, that once a shooter, always a shooter? Like somebody who's a shooter at 10 can still shoot it at 60?
Yeah, I think shooting is a swing skill that's hard to develop at times. You really have to work on it, but when you master it early and you have that size to where he has the wingspan to still get it off over people, that's not going to change.
Yeah, I'm actually interested in the specific things you look for in a shooter, other than he just makes a lot of them. Tell me about like what you look for in a stroke, in a setup, in, you know, how that kind of matches Trey's shooting ability.
Yeah, I think shooting is one of those skills where repetition is probably the most important thing. I think I've grown as an evaluator in terms of actual release of shots and technique, but there are some things that remain pure. And when you watch him versus some of the elite shooters, the fact that the ball gets the type of rotation it does, comes off his final two fingers very easily. He has the rotation, but it's also a repeatable shot, whether he shoots it quickly or has a full time to gather. And he has the range where his body mechanics are exactly the same no matter where he is. And to me, someone that has that type of balance to shoot it off 1 foot, 2 feet, wherever he catches it from, like that's a difficult shot to contest. And for us, I think it's a repeatable shot for him, which makes him the type of high arcing player that he is.
Yeah, you really see that backward rotation off those fingers. But I'm wondering about the release. Do you think it's quick enough?
I do. And I think he was someone in the SEC that had two players draped on him the entire last part of the season. And he wasn't getting a lot of open shots. So for him to be able to create off the dribble, and get those shots, which are a little bit more tough and contested. Playing with the guys that we have now, we hopefully we'll get some easier ones, and he won't need to shoot it as quick. But we put him in drills where you had to catch it, not be able to bring it down, and try to keep that same elbow and release, and he's able to do it now without spending a lot of time on it.
I heard your answer the other night to Trey admitting and appreciating, by the way, that you guys showed him, you know, some of the moments that weren't so flattering for him. And even though you said you weren't thrilled, I thought maybe some of it was tongue-in-cheek. Maybe it wasn't. But I loved your answer when you said that you do it because you want to see how he handles answering it. So what are you looking for in how a player handles seeing some of their rough moments?
Yeah, I think it's a big thing to just see how they communicate. They're going to be put in situations where they're going to have to talk and speak in front of the coaches and their players. I think it shows a sign of humility for a player to admit kind of what's going on, but it also gives us a lot of answers to the test. The reasons why you go to practice and you go to shoot around is to try to understand game plans and schemes and what's really being asked of them. And when players can repeat back and remember the situations and know what the coverages were, it shows you that they're at least watching and trying to get better. So we're looking for people that want to improve, won't run, and be authentic. And we're going to hit you between the eyes while you're here. We want to make sure you can handle that. And I think it's always good for us to get on the front end of that and know the type of person we're coming in, and they know the environment they're walking into. And we're always going to try to get 1% better every single day. And I think while he was here, he did that. And I think that's why he mentioned it, because when you come in, we don't just want to roll the balls out. We want to see where you're at, and hopefully you learn something.
Yeah, you know, over the years, I've talked to so many GMs and coaches who, you know, have said they do the same thing with young players that come in for the interviews, and they're looking to see, you know, when they throw an interception, you know, what happened on this play. And what they're looking for is accountability, but most importantly, did he learn from it? Or is he throwing people under the bus and making excuses? That's a big reveal on character. True?
Very true. The accountability piece, you do get in those film sessions, and it was the coach this, it was my teammate was supposed to be here, so you have to ask those type of questions. But we also try to do a good job of cutting it up so that we're showing the same exact situation and then making the right read as well. So like, okay, tell me the difference between this and this. What part of the season was this? When did you grow and figure this read out? Like, that way we can go behind the process of it. But you're absolutely right. There are some excuse makers out there, and you don't want too many of them in your building, so that's also a tell for us.
One of the things that I noticed in watching Trey in some of those, you know, incredible SEC games this year is just how fearless he was. Like, first game in Vegas against Ohio State, he put up 20 shots. He had 10 three-point attempts and ended up with 29. You've mentioned, you know, the competitive high motors of Riley and of Trey Johnson, and I think the guy you drafted last night as well. With scores and shooters in particular, when a guy walks out onto the court and thinks he's open, the first time he touches the ball wherever he is there a balance of that being really good and also not being great?
Yeah, I think those guys that we drafted with Will Riley and Jameer, they're all at different phases of their career where they're finding themselves still. But they are confident. And when you talk about Trey and some of his performances out the gate, we'd rather have to turn you down than turn you up. And that's kind of what we look for in our players. So we want them to be aggressive, be confident, and go get it from the tip. And we think we added three guys that are going to do that.
Coach Thompson, John Thompson, Jr., as in the legendary Coach Thompson, worked for this station for many years, and he always said, I'd rather have to tame, you know, an animal than resurrect a corpse. And I think that's exactly what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, he said it a little bit more eloquently than me.
No, you said it well, too. So tell us about what you guys liked in Will Riley.
Yeah, so Will's someone who has traditional size for his position. He's someone who, when you watched him prior to coming to Illinois, was someone who had the ball in his hands, could create plays, make shots, and actually get to the rim. And I think we saw that once they had some injuries at Illinois, the second part of the year, they started to put the ball in his hands and give him an opportunity to just create. And he was fearless on the offensive end, went toe-to-toe in another really physical conference. And he's someone who, when we checked in on his body, we expect him to even grow some more. So for him to be able to be 70th percentile in assist and 85th percentile in assist to turnover ratio, it means he protects the ball and looks for others while being able to score. And that's what we're looking for, guys that can just rebound it and bring the ball up. When you have Alex and Keyshawn and Bub, Bilal, and all the guys we have, we just want to play offensive basketball where you don't know who's starting it and everybody can be a threat.
You know, Will, in watching Oklahoma City over the last 2 months, and you were a big part of, you know, the architect of that team, and watching the players that you look for now, man, high motor, intense, highly competitive personalities are a priority for you guys, aren't they?
Yeah, there's a lot of characteristics we look for in the 94 by 50. We're pretty specific on what we look for on the court. But we also have an environmental bucket that we look for, and we send our scouts out there to get as much intel and information as we can to make sure that when we bring these guys into the building, we won't push guys, meaning that we want guys that come in that have similar attributes and are going to just only push the group forward. You don't want too many pull guys that need to be pulled around and eventually try to catch up. So right now we're in the mode of giving everyone that comes in is going to have that competitive fiber and that juice and that work ethic and be serious craftsmen, because that's the environment we're trying to build, so that they push everybody in the gym. So having multiple players that want to compete and get after it, but will do so the right way and be good teammates, those guys are going to do well here in D.C.
You know, Brad Underwood said about Will Riley when you guys picked him the other night, his coach at Illinois said he's the second best offensive player he's ever coached, next to Michael Beasley when he was an assistant with Frank Martin way back in the day. He's got that kind of potential offensively?
I did not see that comment. I got to know him well when he was at Oklahoma State and I was at Oklahoma. And I remember those Beasley days at Kansas State. Those were some fun practices to go watch as a young evaluator.
I bet.
But I would say if he were to go back in the Big Ten, we expected him to have a massive jump, and you wouldn't be getting a player as offensively gifted as him in the 20s. Plus, we were able to move back and still get him and pick up three assets in the second round. So Mike Winger, Mike Hartman, those guys that are helping with our strategy piece. It was a good combination of evaluation and a strategy coming together that first night of the draft. And we knew that we were getting a player who wouldn't be in that range if he would have went back to school. So we bet on that type of development.
All right. Tell me what you got last night in the Florida State kid. Is he Lou Dort?
He is physical. He is long. He is tough. He is defensive-minded. And that's what we really liked about him. But he also is someone that moved the scoreboard and got better offensively. But each meeting with these kids are different, you know. Got to spend a lot of time at dinner with Trey. Actually got a one-on-one breakfast with Will, like, before the workout. And then you get Jameer in your office, and he's just like, I'm all business. I'm here to hoop. Put me on whoever you want. I'm going to compete. And you just felt that vibe, and then he went out there and did it. And you're like, you are who we thought you were, and that's why we targeted him. But he just plays with a force and a physicality on both ends, and that's kind of a rare combination when you can be tops in the country in free throw attempts, but also 75th percentile in steals. So, like, you're hitting people on both ends, and that's what we need.
Is Dort a good comp or not? I mean, the build isn't the same, but is that a good comp?
Not too far off. I think when Lou went undrafted, he kind of had a little bit more of an offensive vibe to him and kind of transformed and realized that's how you get on the floor, and has continued to improve offensively, defensively, and obviously a first-team all-defensive guy from the work he put in. So, again, this is the type of kid you bet on physically to be able to put him in those type of situations.
Do you guys do that? We do that.
Do like all the other guys. Say it again, I'm sorry?
Yeah, no, do you guys do that? We do that all the time. You know, who's his comp? You know, who's his NBA comp? Do you do that as you evaluate players?
Yeah, as long as we're not being lazy with it. As you can imagine in those scouting meetings, I don't want the lazy comps. I want us to think through them, try to find physical comps as well as basketball comps. And sometimes you have to blend the comparisons of the two and let those guys have an opportunity. But it's more of a range. Like, on a high end, he can have this type of impact on a team. And that's the most important thing that we look for.
So what's Trey Johnson's high end comp? Who?
I think he's someone who is going to make plays for others and be able to stay on the floor in the playoffs and impact it on both ends. And that's a high level player for us.
But do you have a name? Do you have a comp?
No, I think you can ask him because he kind of favors his game after a few people. But the guys that are making deep playoff runs that could play on the ball and are always a threat, he kind of fits in the mold of those guys.
We're talking to Will Dawkins, the Wizards general manager. Let me just make sure. Can you talk about the trade at this point from earlier this week or not?
Not officially. That has not gone
okay.
yet.
All right. Then let's just talk about the roster as it stands now, and maybe there are changes coming. We haven't had free agency yet. But size on the roster next year, do you have enough of it, or is more coming?
Yeah, I would say when you look at some of the transactions that haven't gone through yet, when you're having to make those challenging and difficult decisions during the rebuild phase, the main focus is always going to be to put the organization in the position for our long-term success. And for us, the decisions we made and will continue to make are less about position and more about getting the type of guys we want in here stylistically, and then also giving them the runway to develop, but providing us strategically the most flexibility to continue to add. So as we go through this process of free agency and finalizing the roster and making moves and trades potentially, I think we have a good assortment of young players that want to play and veteran players who are more than capable of playing and are actually very beneficial and helpful to have around because they're good players on the court as well. So we have a good blend of who we want in the locker room right now. We'll definitely make a few more tweaks, but I wouldn't say we're after one specific thing heading into free agency.
Well, I think you did, if everybody was paying attention, you kind of answered the question. I think one of the parts that I just want to nail down, because I think you implied it there, is this is the year where it's time to kind of turn the team over to these very young players that you've picked the last couple of years and give them higher usage rates, more shot attempts, more minutes, et cetera, right?
Yeah, I think Brian did a tremendous job. Brian Keefe, our head coach last year, three of those rookies that we drafted were top five in minutes for their rookie class. So he gave them experience, and that's when they were able to produce at a high level. We have a lot of confidence in them, but also Bilal, Champagne, AJ, some of our other young players and the players we've drafted, Tristan, to kind of give those guys an opportunity as well. And at the end of the day, staying flexible and playing deep rotations, I think, is what proved was beneficial for a lot of these teams in the playoffs. So establishing that at an early age, I think, is good as well.
All right, last one, and I appreciate the time. So how excited were you, and how much pride did you take in watching your former team, Oklahoma City, win it all?
Super happy, overjoyed for them, everyone in the city, but everyone I work with and all the teammates that all the players that have come through in the Thunder organization. Definitely excited for all that. They have some great people over there. They deserved it. My family was super excited. My family that lived back in Oklahoma were at the games and at the parade. So happy for them. Hopefully they can keep it going down there, but we're kind of focused on building our own path here in DC, but it was a cool moment for sure.
Congrats on the last few days. Thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it.
No, anytime. You guys have a good one.
Yep. Will Dawkins, everybody, Wizards general manager. We'll talk about some of the things he said, and then Monica McNutt from ESPN will join us at 11 a.m. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980, theteam980.com. You can also watch the show now on the Team 980's YouTube page. Subscribe and like it when you get there.